KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I think we're unlikely to see a change in direction from the White House until we see further pain in financial markets.
It was another volatile day for the markets, and business leaders are starting to speak out about the damage from tariffs.
It's Monday, April 7th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, a decorated combat war veteran who committed a serious crime faces deportation to his home country of Venezuela.
Yes, I committed a horrible crime. I went to prison. I shared my time.
And Bad Bunny is one of the world's most popular musicians.
But he's also kept a close connection to the traditions of Puerto Rico.
I would tell you about so many things that maybe I'm afraid of losing, but the action of starting to take care of and defend what one has is worth more.
Also, the NCAA will crown a men's basketball champion tonight.
We'll preview the big game after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Supreme Court has weighed in on allowing the Trump administration to use an 18th century wartime law to deport Venezuelan migrants, saying it is permissible, but only if there's a court hearing held before deportations take place. In a divided 5-4 decision today, the court said the administration must give migrants it claims are gang members time to go to court, but the court's conservative majority said those hearings must take place in Texas. It's unclear what the order means to those already sent out of the country to a prison in El Salvador under the Alien Enemies Act. The question of what happens next in President Trump's global trade war remains an open one, with little sign he's backing down. During a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister indicated Israel would end any levies against the U.S. Trump also spoke with the leader of Japan today. As NPR's Frank Ordonez reports, little progress appears to have been made with other world leaders.
Trump also used the opportunity to attack others that he said have been unfair to the U.S., such as the European Union. He said an offer by the EU to cut tariffs against the U.S. on autos and other industrial goods was just not good enough. He very pointedly said that the EU needs to do much more, and he said a key thing that they need to do is buy U.S. energy.
Trump also threatened to hike tariffs against China even higher. President Trump today said he's directing a national security panel to take a fresh look at Nippon Steel's bid for U.S. steel. It's a bid President Biden blocked back in January on national security grounds. The White House directive sent the share price of U.S. steel up nearly 14%. Trump administration last month filed a motion to extend two deadlines in U.S. steel and Nippon Steel's lawsuit against a national security panel to give the government more time to wrap up merger talks with the firms. The Trump administration's cuts at the CDC have an impact on global health programs for HIV and tuberculosis. NPR's Fatma Tanis reports the cuts come as part of a widespread reduction at several federal health agencies.
At CDC's Global Health Center, seven branches in the Division for Global HIV and Tuberculosis were completely eliminated, both staff and leadership, around 130 people, according to half a dozen CDC employees who spoke to NPR. Among the branches that were eliminated was maternal and child health. That team was made up of epidemiologists and physicians who focused on preventing babies from getting HIV from their mothers and keeping children with HIV around the world alive and on treatment to suppress the virus. Public health experts say they're concerned about a resurgence in HIV/AIDS cases around the world if these cuts aren't reversed. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Stocks closed mostly lower for a third straight session amid concerns about the Trump administration's tariffs. The Dow fell 349 points. The S&P 500 was down 11 points. The Nasdaq closed up 15 points. You're listening to NPR. Rising floodwaters are continuing to cause problems across the South and areas of the Midwest today. More rain threatening already waterlogged areas, with rivers rising in many spots. Storms are already being blamed for deaths of at least 23 people. From Texas to Ohio, utilities have been working to shut off power and gas as cities deploy sandbags to try to protect homes and businesses. Forecasters say flooding has hit areas in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Alabama. Russia says it still supports the idea of a U.S. negotiated ceasefire in Ukraine, but insists it has yet to receive answers to questions about the plan from the White House. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says how to enforce the ceasefire plan much less prevent Ukraine from exploiting the stoppage to remilitarize, are questions still hanging in the air. Russian President Vladimir Putin had raised those and other issues in rejecting President Trump's bid for a ceasefire following a phone call in March. At the time, Putin also insisted a deal address the root causes of the conflict, in effect a Russian demand that Ukraine end its NATO ambitions and cede territory seized by Moscow. Trump has since expressed growing frustration with Russia's continued attacks on Ukraine, threatening massive tariffs and sanctions if he feels the Kremlin is dragging its feet on negotiations. Charles Maines, NPR News. Moscow.
The death toll from a measles outbreak that hit West Texas, New Mexico, Ohio, Kansas, and Oklahoma has now risen to 3. Since the outbreak began, the number of cases more than doubled compared with a year ago. Once thought to have been virtually eradicated in the U.S., cases began rising this year, primarily among unvaccinated individuals. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's tariffs rocked U.S. stock markets for a third consecutive day of trading. The Dow closed down 349 points after a day of wild swings. And today, Trump escalated the trade war, threatening to slap an additional 50% tax on Chinese-made goods, even though Wall Street CEOs and other business leaders are starting to speak out about the damage these tariffs are causing. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here with the latest. Hey, Maria.
Hey there.
Wall Street has historically been pretty reluctant to criticize Trump publicly. What's changed?
Well, money talks. It was another chaotic day in the financial markets, with some wild swings in the major U.S. indices and a serious sell-off around the world. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index dropped more than 13%, its worst day since the Asian financial crisis in 1997. The U.S. markets didn't take that sort of damage today, but they've still lost trillions of dollars since Wednesday. And pretty much everyone, even people who voted for President Trump, is putting the blame on his trade war. Business leaders generally welcomed Trump's election. They were really looking forward to his promises of lower taxes and deregulation. And at first, they didn't seem to realize just how serious Trump was about this scale of tariffs. But now that we have a clearer picture, they're still trying to stay on Trump's good side, but some are carefully getting more vocal.
What does getting more vocal carefully sound like?
Well, the big headline today was Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase. Dimon runs the country's largest bank, and he's one of the most powerful and prominent people on Wall Street. And today he published his annual letter to shareholders warning that the tariffs will raise prices, slow economic growth, and hurt the country's global standing. He said his, quote, most serious concern is how this will affect America's long-term economic alliances. We also saw some vocal Trump supporters on Wall Street, including billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman, begging the president to back away from the tariffs. Ackman wrote on X that the tariffs are causing an economic nuclear war and warned that the president is losing the confidence of business leaders around the globe.
But tariffs have been such a key part of Trump's worldview for so long. Is he going to listen to this criticism?
People I spoke today are not optimistic. One of them was Brett Howes, an economics professor at Columbia Business School.
I think we're unlikely to see a change in direction from the White House until we see a great deal more voices come forward and we see further pain in financial markets.
Trump seemed to confirm that analysis this afternoon. He threatened to slap even more tariffs on Chinese imports. And then in response to a reporter's question about whether he was looking at a pause on his tariffs to allow for talks, he said he was not looking at a pause. Trump said countries are going to get, quote, fair deals, and that in certain cases they will pay substantial tariffs.
And what kind of long-term damage could that do, big picture?
all kinds of damage. I mean, economists across the political aisle have long warned that Trump's tariffs will raise prices for all consumers. Now we're seeing mounting warnings that they'll also tip the United States and the world into a recession. Goldman Sachs just raised its outlook for a recession this year to almost 50-50. And it said that if Trump doesn't back down on tariffs, it fully expects a recession. Even if that doesn't happen, the chaos in the financial markets is causing real damage to ordinary Americans who have their retirement accounts and other savings invested there. So as long as this trade war keeps getting worse, we're all likely to continue feeling Wall Street's pain.
NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear about a man named Jose Barco. He is a decorated combat veteran who came to the U.S. with his parents as a four-year-old. He now faces deportation to his home country of Venezuela after serving a prison sentence for a serious crime. NPR's Tom Bowman joins us with his story. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Juana.
So, Tom, let's start with his military history. Tell us what happened.
Well, Jose Barco enlists in the Army at 17. He's sent to Iraq in 2004. His unit was hit with this suicide car bomb. He's slammed against the wall, but is still able to save two soldiers under this flaming vehicle. So he was treated for burns, but not for his traumatic brain injury. This was at a time, Juana, when the military really didn't understand the effects of TBI. He eventually did get some help, basically medication, but no real treatment. And he convinced doctors, get this, to send him back to Iraq for a second tour, where he suffers more concussions and also more PTSD because of heavy combat.
So, Tom, Barco served in the U.S. Army, so shouldn't he have been eligible to become a citizen?
You know, right, and many do. Jose filled out the paperwork for citizenship in 2006. His platoon leader remembers that, but the paperwork somehow got lost, and to this day, they don't even know where it is. They assumed he was a citizen.
Huh. So how does this end up with a serious crime?
Well, he gets honorable discharge in 2008, again, suffering from brain injury and PTSD. He returns to Colorado, where his unit's from, and ends up at this house party. He pulls out a gun and shoots into a ceiling. They throw him out of the party, and then he drives past the party, pulls out a gun and shoots into a crowd, striking a young pregnant woman and gives her a serious leg injury. He ends up getting 52 years in prison, but is released after serving just 15 years because he was a model prisoner teaching English and math in prison. He walks out of the prison on January 21st of this year.
Which, if I'm remembering correctly, that's the day after President Trump was inaugurated, right?
That's right. And of course, the president has long spoken about getting rid of immigrants who commit crime. So Barco walks out of prison hoping to attend a family reunion in Florida with his mother, his American-born wife, 15-year-old daughter. Instead, he walks into the arms of agents of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. He's tossed in a van, goes before an immigration judge who orders him deported back to Venezuela, a country, of course, he hasn't seen since he was four. Now, he became a lawful permanent resident after his parents brought him here 35 years ago, but you lose that status if you commit a felony. He was bounced around several ICE detention centers to one finally in South Texas.
Wow, quite the story. Tom, have you talked to Jose Barco directly?
No, I haven't. I've only spoken to his wife and fellow soldiers, but an advocate for Barco talked to him in detention, and he said it's just all surreal.
I thought I earned my case in this country. And yes, I committed a horrible crime. I went to prison. I served my time.
So, Tom, after all of that, did he end up being deported back to Venezuela?
No, he didn't want it. And this is where it gets really strange. He was put on a plane just last week with dozens of Venezuelan detainees. Now, there's this way station in Honduras where they first meet Venezuelan officials. They tell him because of his accent, you're not a Venezuelan, you're Cuban. Which kind of makes sense because both his parents are originally from Cuba, and they tell him the Venezuelan birth certificate he's carrying must be a forgery. So Barco was sent back to an ICE detention center in South Texas where he sits today.
So, Tom, what happens now?
Well, it's uncertain. ICE has not responded to a request for comment from my colleague Quill Lawrence. And Barco's family worries what happens next. And also, I reached out to the family of the woman he shot 15 years ago. They're bitter. They think he should be deported. His advocates say, listen, he's a veteran who served his country, saved his comrades. He doesn't deserve this fate.
NPR's Tom Bowman, thank you.
You're welcome.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Nancy Willis. About 30 years ago, Nancy ran the New York City Marathon. Her entire family made plans to wait for her near the finish line, her husband, her in-laws, and her three children. When Nancy completed the race, she headed to their planned reunion spot, but after getting hugs from everyone, she had a terrifying realization.
My oldest son, Jack, was not with us. And we all set out to try and find Jack, not only just calling his name and looking for this little 8-year-old boy, but we also had the New York City Marathon teams sending out information over the loudspeakers about a missing boy. Even spectators nearby were calling out Jack's name. And that type of energy and focus helped me to stay calm. I had two younger sons who were visibly sad, as well as my mother-in-law. And rather than us becoming despondent and crying, we just turned all our energy into trying to find Jack. And what seemed like more than an hour, but it was probably 10 minutes, a woman came up and was holding my son's hand, and she joined his hand with my father-in-law's hand and said, "Is this your grandson?" And my father-in-law grabbed Jack and held on to him, squeezed him, and we were all obviously very emotional and hugging him. We then turned, in essence, to thank her. And she had disappeared, walked away, blended right in with the crowd. She was not looking for any accolades. She just knew that he was safe. If I ever had the privilege to meet you, I would thank you from the bottom of my heart, because it was probably one of the hardest days of my life. And you fixed it. You stepped in and fixed a big, big hole in my heart. And for that, I would give you the biggest hug in the world and say thank you.
Nancy Willis lives in Madison, New Jersey. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead, online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamoodbell.com/NPR.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The men's NCAA National Championship tonight features two basketball teams you can never give up on, the University of Houston and the University of Florida. Both teams pulled off historic comebacks in the semifinals on Saturday to reach the title game tonight in San Antonio. Texas Public Radio's Dan Katz is here with the latest. Hey there.
Hi.
So, Dan, let's start with the Houston Cougars. It appears that this is just a huge moment for this program on the rise, and I bet it probably doesn't hurt either that this game is being held about 3 hours from their campus.
No, not at all. There are more than 100,000 people here right now for the games, and you could see that Houston Cougar red all over the San Antonio Riverwalk. They've been celebrating that comeback win on Saturday night over Duke that shocked the sports world and the 68,000-plus at the Alamo Dome. Houston was down 14 points with a few minutes left, and they went on a mammoth 11-1 run to pull off the win.
I mean, this was an incredible situation, depending on whether you're a fan rooting for Duke or rooting for Houston. That was either an epic comeback or just a totally epic collapse.
Well, Houston's coach, Kelvin Sampson, wanted to make it clear that his team made their own luck and deserves to be here in the championship. Sampson turned 70 later this year and took a moment to reflect on how much tonight's game means.
I used to come to the tournament when I was a young coach, and I would sit in those stands and look at the two coaches in the championship game, and you know, you'd think you'd like to be there one day. So for me, it's a lot of gratitude, a lot of appreciation for having this opportunity.
And they've had a great season, 35-4. And were the Big 12 conference champions. Yes, they didn't have a possible generational talent like Duke's Cooper Flagg, but they play a style of basketball that you don't see much nowadays. They play a smash-mouth defense team basketball, and they try to make the other team make mistakes, like what happened against Duke.
Coach Kelvin Sampson has been around the game for decades, and he has also been on this sort of long road to redemption, right?
That's right. Some might remember that Sampson was actually forced out at Indiana in 2008, and that's when he was hired by his close friend, San Antonio Spurs coach Greg Popovich, as an assistant, and that resurrected his career with the Spurs and the Milwaukee Bucks and the Houston Rockets before he came to the University of Houston in 2014. And since then, Sampson has retooled his approach to coaching and his style of basketball, and the Houston team has had several deep tournament runs, but they haven't made it all the way. The program has had such greats like Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler come so close also back in the 80s, and Houston fans feel that this could be their moment.
Standing in their way, of course, is this very formidable Florida Gators team. Can you talk a little bit more about how that matchup might play out tonight?
Yeah, Florida has one of the best offenses and has been one of the most exciting teams to watch all season long. Their star guard, Walter Clayton Jr., remember that name, has scored 30 points in their last two games, and that is a playoff feat not accomplished since Larry Bird. And they have several bigs who can really shoot the ball alongside Clayton that helped them pull off a dramatic comeback win of their own in three of the rounds against UConn, Texas Tech, and then Auburn in the Final Four.
I mean, the Gators are a super scrappy, super flashy team, and also they've been here before.
That's right, three times before, in 2000 when they were the runners-up, and in 2006 and 2007 when they won back-to-back national championships. And they're a slight favorite to win coming out of the dominant SEC conference, but what it will all come down to is the top offense, Florida, versus top defense, Houston. And which team with that never-say-die approach can pull off that last run? And clearly, as we've seen in this tournament, if one team has a big lead at halftime, maybe stick around a little while to see how the game ends.
I'm definitely going to be watching tonight. That is Texas Public Radio's Dan Katz. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
This evening, the U.S. Supreme Court backed the Trump administration in its efforts to continue deporting what it says are Venezuelan gang members. By a 5-4 vote, the court's conservative justices threw out a lower court order that had prevented the administration from continuing its deportations under the controversial Alien Enemies Act of 1798. To help us make sense of this, NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here. Hey, Nina.
Hi there, Ari.
So what did the court actually say tonight?
Well, in some ways, remarkably little. In others, a very great deal. So this case was about whether the Alien Enemies Act, which is a controversial law invoked only three times in our history and always in wartime, whether that law was properly invoked by President Trump to deport members of a Venezuelan gang, alleged members, I guess I should say, because in the president's view, all of these men met the criteria of being an invading force from a foreign power, which is what the statute requires. So let's cut to the chase. The court didn't decide that question, but it did basically give the Trump administration probably all it needed to continue with these deportations, with one caveat, and that is that the targets, the alleged gang members, need to have noticed that they will be deported and opportunity to contest their deportation orders.
So if the court did not actually say the Trump administration acted legally in using the 1798 law, what did it say?
Well, what it said was that these cases shouldn't have been in Washington, D.C. at all, that they should have been brought in Texas or in other states where the plaintiffs, the targets, the alleged gang members are being detained, and that the legal theory that they were pursuing was wrong. The court said that not only were the cases brought in the wrong place, they could be brought only as what are called habeas petitions. And habeas corpus, which technically means produce the body, translates in law to basically, you can't hold me without a good explanation and a good reason. And these cases weren't ultimately brought as habeas cases. They were brought as a class action, so they wouldn't have to be litigated one by one, with each person having to find his own lawyer. So now all of these plaintiffs have to go back to Texas or wherever and persuade a judge there or multiple judges there and elsewhere that they shouldn't be deported on a case-by-case basis, and that that is a weaker proposition for people who are in detention already and have to fend for themselves one by one. So you could imagine one detainee might have a great case but can't find a good lawyer, and goodbye, he's back in El Salvador.
And this was a 5-4 ruling, so what did the dissenters have to say?
The dissenters were the court's three liberal justices and Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who increasingly is breaking with fellow conservatives on some of these big Trump cases. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote the principal dissent, noting that the whole court agreed, and even the government now admits, that individuals subject to removal under the Alien Enemies Act are entitled to judicial notice and review before they can be removed. And that, she said, should have been the end of the matter. But the court went way further than it had to, she said, granting the government extraordinary relief, getting rid of the district court's order, etc., without mention of the grave harm that these detainees will face if they are erroneously removed to El Salvador. And she added, without regard to the government's attempts to subvert the judicial process, this is her words, throughout this litigation, because the court should not reward the government's efforts to erode the rule of law, I respectfully dissent, she said.
That is NPR's Nina Totenberg. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Immigration authorities have detained international students involved in protests in recent weeks.
We gave you a visa to come and study, not to become a social activist that tears up our university campuses.
The First Amendment applies to people regardless of their immigration status.
How secure are the free speech rights of non-citizens? That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Jennifer Weiner has written a bunch of hit novels.
But she had a hard time selling her first one, partly because her heroine was a size 16.
It's really hard not to notice the way the world treats larger women, and especially right now.
That's coming up after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Supreme Court has issued a stay or pause in returning a Maryland man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador last month. He had been living in Maryland with legal protection for over 10 years. The Trump administration admitted to mistakenly deporting him, but has refused to bring him back. Here's NPR's Jasmine Garz.
The Trump administration has said Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia's deportation was an administrative error, but has doubled down on saying he was a gang member. U.S. District Judge Paula Zinis says there's no evidence of that and gave the Trump administration a deadline of 12 midnight today to bring Abrego Garcia back to the U.S. The Trump administration quickly asked the Supreme Court to block the order, calling it absurd. Chief Justice John Roberts, in a brief order, says Zinni's order is stayed until the Supreme Court weighs in on the case and that responses should be filed by 5 p.m. on Tuesday. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Even as President Trump promises to expand access to IVF, his administration is eliminating a team in charge of researching fertility treatments. Here's NPR's Sarah McCammon.
Among thousands of federal employees laid off by the Trump administration in recent days was a small team at the CDC in Atlanta. They were responsible for researching the effectiveness of treatments at IVF clinics around the country. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon sponsored a 1992 law that led to the team's creation.
For somebody to say that they want to be the fertilization president and then basically do everything they can to gut the office that was set up in order to do that essential work is absurd.
Officials with the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC, have not responded to...
This is NPR. Another big U.S. drug company has agreed to pay hundreds of millions to settle lawsuits linked to prescription opioids. A division of Veterus sold fentanyl patches, as NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Viatris doesn't admit any wrongdoing or liability, but the Pittsburgh-based company agreed to pay between $27 million and $45 million each year over the next decade to state and local governments. New York's Attorney General Letitia James helped negotiate the national settlement. In a statement, she said a drug company called Mylan, which was acquired by Viatris, quote, deceptively marketed its opioid products as safe, despite knowing they would be abused and sold illegally. One of the firm's products was a highly addictive fentanyl patch. In a statement, Viatris said this deal provides closure. The pharmaceutical industry has agreed to pay more than $50 billion after its products fueled an overdose crisis that still ravages many U.S. communities. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
A Minecraft movie broke box office records over the weekend, earning more than $163 million domestically, nearly doubling Hollywood's expectations for a video game adaptation previously held by the Super Mario Brothers movie. The Minecraft movie is the biggest of the year so far, earning more than $300 million globally. A Working Man came in second over the weekend, followed by The Chosen, Last Supper Part 2. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments,
Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. When you meet the best-selling author Jennifer Weiner, the thing that strikes you immediately is how disarmingly normal and friendly she is.
How are you?
I'm good.
Hi, I'm Juana.
It's so nice
to meet you in person.
Come on in.
Barefoot, dressed in faded black jeans and a t-shirt, Weiner, along with her husband, writer Bill Sykin, and rescue dog Levon, greeted my team and me at the front door of her Philadelphia row house on a recent spring day.
So the house is yours, wherever you guys want to set up.
Weiner's house, like Weiner herself, is welcoming, comfortable, warm. It has high ceilings, big windows, and walls decorated with gorgeous and engaging art. I was at Weiner's house to talk about her 22nd book, The Griffin Sisters' Greatest Hits. It chronicles the rise and breakup of an early aughts sisters band, and it comes out this week. The 21 books that have come before The Griffin Sisters' Greatest Hits were huge hits. But when Weiner began trying to sell her debut novel, Good in Bed, her potential was far from clear, in part because the heroine of her story was a size 16.
And there was a lot of anxiety about that story. I remember when I was trying to find an agent, there was an agent who was interested. She liked the writing, she liked the characters, but she said, like, does she have to be like fat? Like, couldn't we just like give her like 15 extra pounds, like Bridget Jones? Like, I wanted to tell a story as a fat girl. I wanted a story where the fat girl got the happy ending and stayed fat. And I felt really strongly about that. So I decided I wasn't going to work with that agent.
Even once Weiner found an agent, there was still discomfort around the size of the protagonist of Good in Bed, Cani Shapiro.
I found an agent who was okay with Cani Shapiro being the size that she was. And I just remember like going to meetings with publishers and they were like, we think this book is going to be huge. No pun intended. Like, we think it's going to be a giant hit. Like, oh my God, no pun intended. Like, it was just so awkward because, you know, back in the day, like, there wasn't a lot of language. There wasn't a lot of sensitivity. There wasn't a lot. You didn't see fat women. Like, there was fat Monica on Friends, which was Courtney Cox in a fat suit. There was Gwyneth Paltrow in a fat suit in Shallow Hal.
Readers were more than okay with Cani Shapiro, and Good in Bed was a bestseller. Since then, Weiner's published a book about every 18 months. They all do well.
I had this book in my office the other day and somebody walked in and were like, wow, she's got another book coming out. You write so prolifically. And it made me wonder, one, how? Mm-hmm. And two, where and when do you write?
The how of it. I was a journalist for 10 years before my first novel was published. And I learned to write every day and to write on deadline and to be edited and to take suggestions and criticism. And if you are sent out to cover the sewage board hearing, you can't come back to the office and say, I'm sorry, my muse has not spoken to me, so I will not be able to write about this. Like, you and your muse will be unemployed. So, but I also like, This is what I love to do. I like sitting in my little office and like making stuff up. It's my happy place.
And this is my little office.
Wow. Isn't it so cute?
Weiner's happy place is at the end of her bedroom closet.
This is where it is. This is where the magic happens. See, that's Levon's bed. I'm changing out my artwork because my husband did a Zoom where I was on and he's like, the pictures don't look good.
So I used to write at my vanity. Like, I have this enormous closet. It's ridiculous. And then when the pandemic happened, I was just like, you know what? I could really use an office, like an actual office. And so I had contractors come and like make this. They basically put up like a wall and a door. There's a desk and a bookcase and a chair and me and a bed for Levon, my dog. And I'm in there.
Many of Weiner's books feature a plus size heroine. Women being judged and misjudged for their size is something that comes up over and over again. Why is that something that you feel compelled to just keep coming back to?
As somebody who has lived in a larger body her whole life, and as somebody who loves pop culture and loves People Magazine and Us Weekly, and just consuming all the tea about celebrities and women, it's really hard not to notice the way the world treats larger women, and especially right now. It felt for like a hot minute that we were sort of having this like body positivity, and we're not going to shrink ourselves to make the world happy. We are going to live in our bodies. And then, boom, Ozempic. Pendulum has swung all the way back. And I feel like plus size protagonists are more necessary than they've ever been.
Given the sort of moment of the fleeting moment, I would say, of body positivity that we all experienced, now we are where we are. Do you think that your daughters, their friends, young women of their generation, do they feel the same pressure that we've all felt?
I would so like the answer to be no. Sadly, I see them suffering in many of the same ways, probably because of social media, you know? And I also think like our daughters, it's the old saying, like they hear what you say, but much more than that, they watch what you do. So I believe that many women of my generation, we knew to tell our daughters like, no, honey, you're perfect. But if they're watching us, watching the culture, I mean, I know so many women my age on Ozempic. Like, I think they are handing it out like candy. On the one hand, I think that it has not gotten better. On the other hand, I took my daughter shopping for prom dresses over the weekend. And we're in this dress shop, and they have sizes 0 to 24.
I could have never imagined that being a thing that I could have accessed growing up. And I'm in my late 30s.
So my daughter, we're trying on dresses, and she's like, did you go to prom? And I'm like, I did. And she's like, what was your dress like? And I was like, you know, I couldn't find a dress in the store. My mom's friend, Beth Klein, had to sew me a dress because, and I was maybe all of a size 14. I should have been able to go in the store and buy a dress. There was nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with any of these girls. And as awful as I think, as frightening as I think this moment that we're in right now is, as damaging as I believe it's going to be for them, I do hold tight to the idea that at least that's changed, right? Maybe it's a baby step. Maybe it's not going to mean much in the end, but at least the circa 2025 Jenny Weiner could have walked into a store and found a pretty dress.
And maybe that baby step is in some small part influenced by the fact that those plus-size protagonists in Weiner's books have something else in common. They triumph. They get the job, the guy, the happy ending, all without having to lose weight. And tomorrow on All Things Considered, more of our conversation with author Jennifer Weiner about her latest novel, The Griffin Sisters' Greatest Hits.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Guitarist Amadou Bakayoko has died. He was 70 years old. He was half of the renowned duo Amadou and Mariam. Known as the blind couple from Mali, they lifted their country's music to stages around the world. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has this appreciation.
Amadou Bakayoko picked up his first instrument as a toddler. It was a West African drum known as a djembe. By the time he was 10, he played harmonica and flute. Guitar came soon after. As his musical talents blossomed, Bakayoko lost his vision. He'd been born with a cataract in his eyes, and by the age of 16, he was blind. He spoke about that period of his life with NPR's World Cafe.
Non, c'était pas difficile, je l'ai préparé parce que...
saying it was not difficult because he'd prepared himself for that moment. He soon arrived at Mali's Institute for the Young Blind. There, a singer named Mariam was learning Braille and giving music lessons.
Amadou's guitar and the beautiful voice of Mariam do not take long to harmonize within the group Eclipse, made of both sighted and non-sighted musicians. This group travels far and wide through the cities and bushland of Mali, raising awareness of health problems that can lead to blindness.
Amadou and Mariam fell in love and started a band together in the 1980s. That's an interlude from their album Eclipse that recounts their origin story. For decades, their sound merged Malian blues with rock and pop influences. The duo eventually moved to Paris. In 2005, they released their breakthrough album, Dimanche à Bamako, or Sunday in Bamako. It was a collaboration with the European singer and producer Manu Chao. Amadou and Mariam went on to appear at festivals around the world and performed a series of concerts in complete darkness. They spoke to NPR's Weekend Edition with the help of an interpreter.
On l'avait voulu faire pour que les gens qui voient puissent se mettre dans le monde des non-voyants.
We wanted to put people who can see into the world of those who can't. You can appreciate music even without vision. You can lean into your imagination. There's actually a lot you can learn by listening to music without trying to see.
Lyrically, Amadou and Mariam celebrated their love and joy of life, but they also instilled a message of hope and resilience to the people of Mali during difficult socio-political circumstances. This song, Demi Senou, advocates for the well-being of children, even as the country faced high levels of unemployment and sickness. Amadou and Mariam continued touring and releasing music until the end of Amadou's life. In 2024, they performed at the closing ceremony for the Paralympic Games in Paris. Bagayoko died last week in Mali. He is survived by his wife and musical partner, Mariam, their son, and their grandchildren. Thousands of people gathered in Bamako over the weekend to pay their respects. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. When was the last time you read a book? A new NPR Ipsos poll dug into the reading habits of American adults. NPR's Andrew Limbong has the results.
The first question I asked Mallory Newall, the vice president of public polling at Ipsos, was, is America a reading nation?
We certainly want to be a reading nation. I think what this poll tells us is many Americans enjoy reading, broadly see it as relaxing, get a lot of value, a lot of connection from it.
You can tell from her voice that a but is coming and well.
But we're not necessarily prioritizing it as a leisure activity. I think instead for many, especially for younger people, it's certainly more aspirational.
Here are some numbers. The poll surveyed more than 2,000 American adults. 51% said they read a book in the past month. That's compared to 80% who watch streaming TV, 78% who say they use social media. Here's the thing, though. It's more complicated than just streaming and social media replacing reading, because respondents who classified as readers were also more likely to watch TV and use socials. So what's going on here?
I think reading is up against the fact that we just don't have enough time in the day. It's not one particular thing.
When asked which of the following are reasons that you don't read more, yeah, work and other forms of entertainment charted pretty high, but by far the number one choice was, I don't have enough time because of other life activities, which could include anything from hanging out with your kids to sleeping. So who is reading? The poll asked, if you had one extra hour of leisure time in your day, how would you most like to spend it?
Women are significantly more likely than men to say that they would spend that extra hour reading. Folks with a higher education, 4-year degree or more, are much more likely than those with lower educational attainment to say the same thing.
But one of the strongest demographic indicators for reading is age.
There's almost this transition that we undergo over the course of our lives, that by the time we get older, reading is more ingrained in our daily or weekly routine.
Which is a lot easier if you don't have young kids or are retired. Newell says women and people over the age of 50 drove the genre that is the clear favorite among readers.
Thriller, crime, mystery, obviously it's had a moment in recent years with the explosion of true crime podcasts and things like that, and that does top the list.
But to go back to what Mallory Newell said up top, there is still a very strong aspiration towards reading, particularly among younger people. 71% of respondents between the ages of 18 and 34 said they want to become a better reader. They just got to find the time to do it. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Bad Bunny is one of the most popular musicians in the world, and he's built a huge global audience while remaining engaged in the politics of Puerto Rico, where he's from. His latest album, released in January, is his most explicitly political yet. It focuses on one particular issue that's crucial to people who care about Puerto Rico, which NPR's Ana Maria Serra discovered when she visited the island a week after the album was released.
I land on the island, order my Uber, and the ricketiest old gold Kia Sedona pulls up. What do I hear blasting out the windows? Debí tirar más fotos.
Debí tirar más fotos de cuando te tuve. Debí darte más besos y abrazos las veces que pude.
Out hops my driver. His name is Kevin Torres. He's got fluffy hair and the brightest smile. He's the exact same age as Bad Bunny, and they were born in the same place, Bayamón, Puerto Rico. But Torres was never really a fan. That is until this year, when he heard these words.
Quieren quitarme el río y también la playa. Quieren el barrio mío y que abuelita se vaya.
They want to take away the river and also the beach. They want my neighborhood and they want my grandma to leave. That's Bad Bunny's song, Lo Que Le Pasó a Hawaii. It's a song about the fears many Puerto Ricans feel in the face of rising gentrification and tourism. A reminder that what happened in Hawaii, what many see as an erasure of culture and tradition, it could happen in Puerto Rico. A rallying cry to Puerto Ricans to stay, preserve their culture, and fight for their island.
Aquí nadie.
Nadie quiso irse y quien se fue sueña con volver.
For Torres, the urgency expressed in this song, it's personal. He tells me that he's been hustling for 10 years, on the island, trying to make ends meet. But he's at a breaking point, and he's making plans to move away within a few months.
I don't want to go. I do not, like, for the life of me, I do not want to go.
Bad Bunny and Kevin Torres' generation grew up in a Puerto Rico that was steeped in tension. Amidst ongoing rifts over colonial status, the overthrow of a governor, weakening power grids, and rising gentrification. Maybe that's why their attachment to the island is so strong.
It's like I've always said, como que aquí yo nací, like I was born here, aquí yo muero, I'll die here.
Quieren quitarme el río y también la playa.
Just a month later, I met Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, Bad Bunny himself. He was in Washington, D.C. to play at NPR's Tiny Desk. Now, his music is typically built on synthetic rhythms, electronic percussion, more rapping than it is singing. But the first notes of his performance of Lo Que Le Pasó a Hawaii at the Tiny Desk solidified how important the preservation of tradition is to him. He brought an ensemble who played classic Puerto Rican instruments. Cuatro players, pleneros, congueros. I talked to him after his performance, and he explained this focus on preservation.
Siempre uno vive con miedo de perder cosas.
One always lives in fear of losing something, he told me. When you're afraid of losing something, what you do is take care of it even more. Protect it, defend it. For Bad Bunny, overcoming that fear, it's why he's chosen to surround his lyrics with music that upholds Puerto Rican traditions. I would tell you about so many things that maybe I am afraid of losing, but the action of starting to take care of and defend what one has is worth more than saying you are afraid. So before I say I'm afraid, I'm ready to overcome that fear. That desire is something I heard clearly 1 month earlier in Puerto Rico from Kevin Torres.
I want to have something, I want to build something here that'll pay forward. I want to be remembered as somebody that did well for others, that helped build more people that build other people up.
As I continued listening to Bad Bunny's album, I couldn't get Torres out of my head. About a month after our initial conversation, I reached back out to him just to see if anything had changed. He was still listening to Debí Tirar Más Fotos every day, and something had changed. Home was worth fighting for, and he had decided to stay.
I can't be a dying breed.
Ana María Sayer, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the John D.
That I can see each morn when I arise, two young cuckoos, how they feel in school. Now, Lady Bird, don't say a word, but love is in her eye. She will sigh and look away, then is when you'll hear him say, cuckoo, you got me, cuckoo. No bird can coo like you coo. I'll break my wishbone, wishing for you. Take me, do. Little lovebird, I like the way you're alto. contralto. We'll stick together in all sorts of weather. 'Cause cuckoo, I'm cuckoo over.